This is the PropTech VC Podcast. We give you unique insights into how innovative technologies are disrupting real estate. We interview top entrepreneurs, investors, and knowledgeable experts to share the inside scoop in this fast-moving industry. It's hosted by leading PropTech VC, Zane Jaffer. Let's dive into today's content.
We're here today with Kyle Stoner, a serial entrepreneur who's also been a former investment banker, currently the founder and CEO of Abode. Kyle, walk us through the story. How did you start Abode and what's your career been like? What led you to this moment?
Thank you for having me today. Yeah, so, you know, I started off as an engineer and then an investment banker, and I've started three companies. The first one was Pangea Money Transfer, which is the highest rated money transfer app in both the App Store and Google Play. Second one was Alpha Lead, which was a two-sided marketplace that matched people that have disabilities to attorneys to help them get their disability benefits. And through that process, both my co-founder and I were personally buying and selling real estate, residential real estate. And we were just struck by how broken that process was. From everything from the sort of manual workflows between us and the real estate agents, everything was, you know, sometimes you get email, but even like fax, if you can imagine that. Lots of, you know, calls, and there's just nothing to manage that whole thing. At the same time, we were paying, very high exorbitant fees in the form of commissions to these brokers. And so all of those things together sort of just blew our minds. And so we first started like thinking about with Alpha Lead, this little bootstrapped startup we had, we thought, oh, we'll pivot that. We won't just match to attorneys. Maybe we'll match to discount agents and lawyers and inspectors, appraisers, all these different things you need when you buy or sell a home. And then as we went down that road, we quickly realized that real estate's its own beast. It's so big and it's so specific and it's regulated that you really need to have a focused effort towards it. So we started Abode. We applied to Techstars here in Chicago. I think like 10,000 companies applied and they took 10 of us in that cohort. And so once we were chosen for that Techstars cohort, we knew we had some outside validation and we could kind of run on something. And so that's what we did.
So let's get straight. You were buying real estate whilst you were running another startup and you were so frustrated with that process. I'm guessing it was taking a lot of your time up. You just decided, screw this. I'm going to find a way to get rid of the lack of transparency, these exorbitant fees, as you said. So you just let that startup continue, you left it, you continued to run it. How did you make the transition into actually turning this into a company?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So we wound down. So that was part of the flight. One of the reasons we started Alpha Lead was we'd had a venture-backed experience. And we were like, oh, that was okay. We raised capital, we understood it. We said, next time we start something together, Carson's been my co-founder in all three companies. We said, let's start something that's bootstrapped. Let's see if we can just go. Let's run. Because in the past, it was like, okay, let's run, but first let's go raise capital so that we can run, right? And that was a little bit frustrating. So we wanted to see if we could just do it. That's what we did. And so it was easier for us. We had that flexibility because we were the shareholders to say, okay, we found a larger opportunity that's more exciting to us. Let's wind this down. And we had customers that were paying us monthly, so we had to do things to help transition those customers to other partners we had, and so we were able to do that. And then we just ran full speed on Abode.
And that's funny. A lot of first-time entrepreneurs believe they need to go raise funding, and that's sort of an excuse not to go and validate the market and start building things and hiring people. Yep. Of course, you need funds to hire people, but you know, a lot of energy, most of the energy is always contingent on, well, once I raise funding, things will be better, and you've walked that road before. I mean, I've done it too. And it's amusing now that you realize I'd rather bootstrap it from the ground up. So is that mindset still in place? When is the right time to raise funding?
Yeah, so the right time to me is when you absolutely need to do it. For us, you know, and if you think about sort of the world we were stepping into, take a step back. We thought we could build a fairly decent sized business. When I say fairly decent, seven-figure run rate with profits to pay ourselves nice, well, without raising capital, with Alpha Lead. And we were kind of headed down that road. Within 6 months of launching, we had a fairly solid five-figure MRR. Unit economics were really good. And we were starting to understand, like, if we could start putting a dollar in, we'll get, you know, $3 back, whatever that equation was, right? With real estate, it was a little bit different because one of the reasons we applied to Techstars is that our first sort of iteration of this thing mimicked what a typical real estate flow is, which is you hire somebody to help you with your transaction, and then you do a bunch of things with that person. You look at houses, or you invite people to look at your house, and then no money changes hands until an actual deal takes place.
It's crazy, but let's just take a step back for a second. When you absolutely need it, some would say that's the worst time to raise it. When you absolutely need it, it's too late. By that point, you're going to get bad terms, and it's obvious to investors, you know, wow, you're running out of cash. What do you mean by when you absolutely need it?
Yeah, so what I mean is, and so what we decided when starting a boat is that we needed capital to actually make the thing work. So for us, it was, we're going to acquire a customer today, which, by the way, will usually cost you something. And then we're not going to get paid until somewhere 6 months down the road. So during that 6 months, you need to build the thing, continue to acquire customers, iterate, do all the things you need when you're building a company. All those, a lot of those things cost money. And it was beyond what we could bootstrap on our own. And so that's why we knew immediately this was going to be a venture-backed vehicle.
That's right. And there's no golden rules. It looks like you've lived on all spectrums, right? Maybe raising funding when it wasn't the right time, and then bootstrapping perhaps, you know, to a point where you needed it. There's no golden rule behind when you should raise funding, but there are some businesses, and you've got to be honest with yourself as a founder, right? There are some businesses where this is going to need money to get off the ground. And you have a duty in some ways when you take venture capital. You've got to appreciate where that money comes from and what the investors are trying to achieve. Some businesses require significant upfront capital investment and the potential to generate exponential returns. Those are businesses where it makes sense to go as venture funding, and that's when there is an alignment. VCs are okay with the risk. I mean, people need to realize that, right? As long as the returns are there. But some people just use it as an excuse where, you know, I want to go start something small, but I want venture funding because that's the hot thing to do and that's what everyone does. And that's clearly an insight, you know, you can only gain once you go through the process.
Yeah, I mean, I think I came at it a little bit differently too. I mean, coming from the finance side, I don't have any real emotion around the fun or the drudgery of fundraising. To me, it's simply an input and an output. I'm looking at a financial model and I'm saying, oh, if, in order for me to get to June, I need this much capital, right? And so for us, I came from at it from a different perspective. And also in Chicago's not a big like VC town, and so there's not as much romanticism around venture capital as there is maybe on the Bay Area.
That probably helps a lot, though. Although now today in a world where things are more remote, people are stuck to TechCrunch, people are stuck to LinkedIn and are reading about funding announcements. And it always makes entrepreneurs insecure when they see a competitor raise funding. So I get that. But I guess being in banking too, you must get numb to large numbers as well, right? With the volume of transactions that you're processing, it really is an input and an output, right? And you have to appreciate that.
That's right. No, I think that's correct. I think, you know, I think you said it the right way. I mean, for us, when I was in banking, you'd routinely work on a transaction where it could be debt, it could be equity, it could be anything, but it might be, you know, hundreds of millions, a billion, you know, billions of dollars. And so when it comes to numbers, that's what you're used to seeing. And then you come to kind of startup land, and sometimes like 500K could like make or break your startup. You know what I mean?
And it's so very hard small. To raise, right? And there you are, and it's a different asset class, but there you are in banking managing, I don't know what endpoint it is, whether it's millions, billions, trillions, right? They're all order of magnitudes more than the 50K, 500K check a startup needs to get off the ground.
Correct, yep, that's right. And so I really had to kind of change my, so our first startup, Pangea, I think the first, I want to say 500K we raised, a lot of it came from people I met in the banking world, right? And so it was really helpful to make that transition because I had access to capital that I probably would not, if I had stayed an engineer, I would never have met any of these people. And so our first couple angels were people that I'd done deals with on the banking side. And then I was able to say, hey, I'm doing this new thing, here's the opportunity, and was able to get those first few checks. Without that, I don't know if it just would have been really difficult.
Pretty much in quote, friends and family money, basically.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and I think, like, that's the thing, right? In the very beginning, it's your baby, and you're typically not generating any revenue. You may not even have the full product built. And we were in money transfer, so you had to do a lot of things from a regulatory standpoint to be able to transmit $1. Otherwise, it's like a federal, you know, it's a felony to do these things. And so we had to build a lot of infrastructure, put a lot of deals in place before we could transmit dollar one. And again, there's a lot of capital that had to be put up to set that up. And so really, it's your friends and family typically that are going to take that bet on you, and we don't have anything else. Outside, again, I'm not a Valley guy, so I think in the Bay, there's a lot more of that risk capital where people are able to do deals on napkins or do deals like, ah, I kind of know this person, I saw them at Google or whatever, I'll back them.
It's also a culture, because if you take your friends, for example, in Chicago, right? And this, mm-hmm. this could apply to any city. It could be Moscow, it could be London, it could be Berlin, Paris. What is the culture around startups and investments there, right? So some towns across America, the culture is you grow up on a farm and, you know, you guys buy land and you'll do some exporting, importing.
Sure.
Other places, and this is probably the majority, is people know people in real estate, and you know, it's kind of normal to go invest in a home. And yep. In the Valley, the mindset is different. Here, you grow up around people who you see make a lot of money in startups, you see make a lot of money in venture capital, so it's kind of a loose thing. Oh, I know this guy, he sounds cool, I'll throw 50K, I'll throw 20K or whatever. Yeah. Also remember, the engineers here earn insane amounts of money, right? In fact,
sure.
To live in a place like San Francisco or any new, you know, HQ number two, you could call it, right? The Austins or whatever, salaries are rising and there's all that disposable income. And what do engineers do? They invest in things they understand and know, which is going to be
That's
tech.
Right.
But moving back to your example though, did your, quote, friends and family money, did they understand the nature of the risk profile of the asset class? How did you sort of take on the pressure of raising money from your friends, and how did you sort of set expectations? Because when I ran my company and I raised my first round, I raised it from a professor of mine, who, can you imagine, you always want to impress your professor and get the highest grades possible, right?
Yeah,
now imagine
yeah.
you've taken their money, the pressure you must feel, wow. right? So, you know, the head of the school invested in our startup, Vungle. And then we went out and raised $2 million. And a lot of it was from savvy investors. But a lot of it were from just other engineers and other angel investors. And it was a meaningful check for them. And it was very hard to sleep knowing I'd raised $2 million. And, you know, it was burning cash like crazy. How did you handle that stress as a founder yourself and your friends particularly?
It's a really good question. I think that, again, I had the benefit of coming from a background where these people were like very sophisticated investors already, right? And so those first few investors that we had, they were, I mean, I think almost exclusively either, you know, certainly had MBAs and had often worked in private equity, banking. One of the it was like almost like a family office, one of our biggest checks. Before, I mean, this is like, you know, they're talking 2012, and so family offices I don't think were even as much of a thing as they are now. But this was a wealthy family who had invested in all kinds of things and had done a lot of kind of early stage stuff too.
So they understood it. They understood the risk
profile,
et
cetera,
right? Mm-hmm. Now, how do bankers view the startup asset class, at least from your experience where you've worked and where you've been, and maybe you could tell us a bit about that to set context. How do people think of the startup asset class, and what did your friends advise you? Did they think you were nuts to go into a startup?
Oh,
or was it exciting and cool because they'd read Fortune or Forbes and read about Zuckerberg and, you know, think that's what you're going to do next?
It's a bit of both. You know, when you think about like the way bankers look at angel investing, I find that they view it just like their other deals. And so the diligence level is extremely high, higher than many VCs in a lot of ways. And so I remember doing, you know, a deal, and this, you know, single angel was like, okay, so now it's time for, I need your, all your social security number. I'm going to do a background check on you. Like, it was like real serious stuff, you know?
So how much were you raising?
So at that time we were raising, I think, our first million.
Okay.
And so we were getting like a lot of like 25 and 50K checks.
And with guys who are giving you 25 and 50K, do that much due diligence?
Yeah, the banker said, yeah. I mean, they're used to, that's how they do deals, right? Like that's how, and so they're like, they're really doing an underwriting process. They want to know what their downside is. A lot more downside focus than I think the type of investor you're talking about in the Valley that's like, this could be a rocket ship and I want to get in for that potential lottery ticket. These guys are like, you know, I'm making kind of like 15% a year of my money over here. This could be a rocket ship, but I'm not taking a zero. Nobody's taking zeros here. So like, what is my downside?
Well, it's the same in the prop tech landscape. I don't know if you've experienced this, but a lot of startups turn to their customers to make investments into their company. And these folks typically are very concentrated in real estate. So what do? They look at a startup like they look at real estate, and they also focus on the downside protection and underwriting.
That's right. I mean, we've had some success with that before. We've had some investors for, or sorry, some partners we have, for instance, pay us early for services. That's sort of an investment. You know, we're getting a cash advance against some services, but we haven't done one for equity yet.
Right.
Thank you.